Can't pick Cat in the Hat. They did that. In honor of the Goldfinch, what book that you love would make a terrible movie?
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with City of Glass. I guess it's more of a story. It's part of Paul Auster's New York trilogy, that meta-detective fiction series, and I think it could probably be a good, like, short film or maybe, like, a TV anthology series, but it's not going to be a good movie. No, no, no.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I'm going to pick Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Boom! Burned. Burned.
Get burnt.
I mean, it was a fine horror movie, but it wasn't good.
Well, we specifically were looking for terrible movies.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room number 272 for the week of Wednesday, September 11th, 2019. And on that day in 1962, the Beatles recorded their first single, Love Me Do.
Sing it. We have the rights, right?
That's the one?
I'm getting Beatles mania here. Wait, is that how it goes?
I was told that love was just a fairy tale.
What? No.
Oh no, no, that's the fucking Shrek. I have a monkey song.
It's from the Shrek. Yeah, no, so
Love Me Do. Does Love Me Do also start off with keys though?
Off with keys?
Love Me Do. Da, 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 da,
yeah, you got it.
Yeah, all right. Just
that should also have been Shrek. We want to hear Shrek sing it. In honor of the 57th anniversary, Shrek, record that. I can't
yes,
do it.
Let's do a Shrek Love Me Do. That's
Donkey.
What else is Mike Myers doing?
I love me do.
All right. I don't know exactly how this episode's going to sound when you actually hear it, but we're recording it in chunks because Patches and I are here now, and Katie and David are still in Toronto attending a film festival they're going to report back to us on. But Patches and I are here talking about other things, including reading some reviews, if I understand correctly.
That's right. We took a little summer break last week for the Labor Day holiday. Now we're back, and we got two reviews, which is good, I think. How long ago did we... we got two reviews. Let's see what we got here. From Gville Guy 1124 says, a home for macro level pop culture discussion. Great podcast that covers topics I mostly care about. Intriguing blend of hosts that offer often contrasting viewpoints, but Patches needs to fix his microphone. His voice drifts in and out, which prevents me from hearing his comments that I mostly find relevant. Well, diss, but I think my audio is pretty good. Maybe he means David. Well, I'm going to take the compliment
at
the end.
Turn your head away from the microphone.
That's true. I'm often drifting in, I'm thinking, I'm so lost in thought that I look up to the heavens for answers.
Well, there's another secret, behind-the-scenes secret. You hold your microphone sometimes.
I'm currently holding my microphone. It's sitting on my tum.
Yeah, yeah. So you're,
weird?
Like,
that's
rolling around on a couch, just, like, talking about movies.
That's true. I like to be one of these shock jocks. It's like, I'm in a different kind of position every time, and I'm grabbing the microphone. It's not amateur hour. It's just art, man. Anyway, I'm going to focus all of my vocal energy towards the microphone for this episode as a gift.
That's
to
good.
Gville Guy 1124. Thank
I like
you for
that. No, I just like that in general. That's a good thing to do in general.
I will. Our second review is from Royale Ripoff, who 5 stars says, all about my Ehrlich. I'm glad we're reading this one without David here, so his head doesn't inflate too far. David Ehrlich is the lifeblood of this podcast. Katie is great when she has seen the movie the gang is discussing. Matt Patches and Dave Seven are also good, but they sound like the same person. Oh, you're going to love this episode. So you guys have to talk to Ehrlich. God forbid Ehrlich on the verge of a nervous breakdown, because this podcast would be just fine to listen to. You could ridicule this podcast to Payne and Ehrlich. Then again, what have I done to deserve Ehrlich? Maybe we have to tie Ehrlich up, tie Ehrlich down. That's probably the flower of Ehrlich's secret, being a contrarian. So retitle this podcast Ehrlich Habits. Make the rules of the podcast be the law of Ehrlich. Make it a labyrinth of Ehrlich. In the end, it's okay, but 5 stars for Ehrlich. Wow.
I mean,
that's some
would,
poetry.
If we made that podcast, you know who wouldn't listen to that podcast?
David.
David.
Yeah, no. Tell David to tweet about our podcast, everybody.
You want me to listen to it every week?
That's true. He commits himself and can only go in one direction. So that's how we know we're safe to badmouth him here. But this review praised David and praised us all a little bit. So, you know, we all come together. Everyone has their favorites. And you should shout that out in your own iTunes review. Leave it. I don't know how the iTunes algorithm works anymore. I read something that like Apple's now prioritizing their own content and apps, and it's a whole rigmarole on Apple. So I don't know if people will see those iTunes reviews. Can you leave Stitcher reviews? Can you leave, what are the other types of podcast apps? I use Overcast. Can you leave an Overcast review?
I think we initially pushed for iTunes reviews because at the time, you know, the app, like iTunes existed as an app, first of all, that like was still being updated, which isn't true anymore. And it used to be important to get reviews in for the algorithm. But you're right. I don't know if the algorithm's current anymore in their transition to, you know, making themselves a more hub-based,
recommendation-based
service.
How can we bring reviews back to the people so they don't feel like they need to be on iTunes? How can we bring them back to a relevant space that will help spread the love back and forth from audience to hosts and host to audience and spread the influence of this essential podcast in the movie space? Number one podcast on iTunes, I believe. I haven't checked, but it's pretty big.
We could start using our comments section on our website.
We have fightinginthewarroom.com. I do check it. People just don't go there and leave comments. It's a big ask. It's a lot of letters to type into your URL bar. Is it URL bar? So that's a big commitment. A lot of people probably use apps to listen to the episodes as opposed to listening to them on our website. But I occasionally, do you ever listen to podcasts, on a website as opposed to in your app if you're like sitting at your desk?
Not usually. What I'm more liable to do and what you can do at our website is click the little download link on their player there. And then I have like the MP3 file on my main computer. That's the useful part of a podcast website for me. But I could, you know, I also have multiple computers running because I push my CPU in a lot of ways constantly. And
Where do you listen to podcasts, Dave?
Where?
Where do you, like, where would you go? Because you work from home.
Yeah.
You stay at home a lot. Where do you go? Where you would, do you drive around?
No, not really. I mean, I walk.
Take long strolls with your podcasts.
Yeah, and then just like around. So like there are certain repetitive acts in my life that don't require my ears. And so I'm either editing a podcast while doing something like playing video games.
Woodworking.
Woodworking. Actually, I've been doing like a little bit more drawing for something else. Yeah. So I've been listening to audiobooks and podcasts for that. You are listening to Fighting in the War Room. We're here to talk about other things. Leave us some reviews, one of those many ways, but also on iTunes because we think it helps us there. And that's where David will read them for the time being. Onward.
Dave, talk to me about It Chapter 2, because it's a hit horror film that just released in the USA. It is a follow-up to It Chapter 1. I guess that was not the title of that
original. I love me that It Chapter 1.
Do you love It Chapter 1? A lot of people do.
I actually do. I have read It. And was fan enough of the, you know, television adaptation in the sense that, you know, it's not a great horror artifact by any means, but Tim Curry's performance in it is amazing and nightmare inducing, even by just being, he wasn't wearing a lot of prosthetic makeup for a lot of the, you know, non-effect shots, because he'd just come off doing what, Legend, where he was the devil. And so his like one like request with like Pennywise is, could he be like closer to himself? So it's mostly Tim Curry performance. And then Bill Skarsgård in the new It, both of them, also does a great job, I think, bringing this character to life. I think the first movie did. So the promise of the first movie is it's It, you know, and then at the end, there's a promise that there could be a chapter two, but it is basically centered on the child versions of these characters. The rest of the novel, the whole novel is intercut so that you get to both climaxes. I guess mild spoiler alert for It Chapter 2. I don't know. It's out. And judging from box office intake, those of you that really wanted to see it have already. They're both like encounters in the sewer with It end up being towards the end of the book. Rather, It Chapter 2... It Chapter 1, because it had like a single story to tell, and this like kids rising up to face this monster to tell, and like a very specific type of horror, I think worked really well and actually was scary. It Chapter 2 is not scary, and it has a couple of problems. Most of them are like have to do with weird tone and pacing problems, like made in the movie. It feels like It Chapter 1 was such a success that they got, you know, the money they needed to do It Chapter 2.
And I mean, just to put it into perspective, like, this is a $35 million horror movie. It, the original 2017 It, was maybe $35 million and made $700 million worldwide. It was absolutely huge. It's like the highest grossing horror movie of all time. They must have done something right, so you would give Andy Muschietti kind of free reign over the sequel, in theory.
And then I think what happened is he wanted too complex of like a tale of It to really allow it to chapter two to thematically become cohesive. So it's pretty funny in places and kind of like a science fiction film about, you know, these existential deadlights in places. And I don't mind any of those things. But then when it comes to the actual characters and the Losers Club, when they're together, it's good. Like the first time, the stuff in the Chinese restaurant, I actually loved. But then they split them up. The movie splits them up again, so they each have to go find their totems. And this is like mostly an excuse to have more extended scenes with the younger cast, who have been, you know, partially digitally de-aged, so they look like they're still like of the first movie age. Because, you know, 2 years is some time for kids who are growing, as we're learning on while rewatching Lost. So I think that sort of really stunts the movie's forward momentum, because everyone's remembering Pennywise and is scared of Pennywise, but what we see of him terrorizing them is actually extensions, you know, of what we've already seen in It Chapter 1. And we already like those characters, and it's great to see them again. But the movie has trouble after the introduction scene, I think, of Stan, and then getting them all to the Chinese restaurant after that, with becoming this fractured narrative that they're just reliving the traumas of the first movie as adults, which doesn't allow so much for different types of scares. And it really makes it seem like the monster is less threatening, because there's like tons of times. The first kill we see in the movie is actually one that's adapted from the book, which is the killing that's based on the real life 1984 killing of a young gay boy in Bangor, Maine, that King then adapted into the book. There's a homophobic attack on this couple, and they throw one of them off the bridge, and then Pennywise sort of like eats him. But he's an adult, and he like gets eaten by the clown immediately, and you're terrified again of this clown. and then weird stuff happens at the Chinese restaurant. You're terrified to get at this clown. And then we spend an hour, maybe more. I wasn't really looking at my phone for the time, even though I did sometimes because the movie's that weirdly paced. We get splintered back off into the child cast, and the Pennywise's threat, I think, is reduced. And then the other half is they tried to adapt the ritual of Chud or Chud from the book, which in the book is this ritual where you bite the other person's tongue and tell them jokes, and the first one who laughs, like, loses, but this, like, battle takes place in, like, a metaphysical time-space. Where they see, like, a turtle that, like, runs the galaxy, and they learn that it's, like, this galaxy-hunting being. They try to adapt parts of that through basically, like, some Native American lore that's carved on this, like, catching box that they have Mike find, which is not from the book. It is, like, sort of, it is, like, a Himalayan ritual from the book, and I think there's also a period in the book where they go to the sweat lodge, and that's where, you know, Bill, I think, hallucinates the origins of it. This movie has Mike do that by, like, drugging Bill and forcing him to hallucinate. So they know it, like, came from a comet, but the ritual has been reduced to something on screen friend, or that I guess is more screen friendly, where they have to, like, hold hands around this bucket and chant, and then it doesn't work. And it's just so puzzling, a storytelling choice to spend the bulk of your movie rehashing your previous movie for this ritual that is not a straight adaptation of the book, but is like a half-baked version of it, and then it doesn't work, so like it didn't lead to anything anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really weird decisions in just storytelling.
It just seems so strange to spend 3 hours on the sequel when maybe 3 hours would have done the combined story, and the whole point was to split it in half. I
think it's as long as the television miniseries. Like, if you take the commercials out of the television miniseries that's in two parts, I think this is as long a single movie. And it really feels like it is the problem, because there's so many stuff in it that, you know, wouldn't, like, in the book, like, historical things that would have been great to see on screen, and even after the production of the first It, Andy Muschietti and Bill Skarsgård talked about, like, filming some of those things, like, earlier, him, like, a carnival or whatnot, and instead of taking that historical tack, they double back on the characters, but it doesn't work because all the character work is rooted in the children, and because of that, the adult actors have to, like, perform it out. And I think Bill Hader is successful at that, just, like, at walking. Maybe it's because, you know, we like Bill Hader, and, you know, his Finn Wolfhard, who plays younger Richie, like, we like Stranger Things. Like, we have a relationship with those two actors, so they could just, like, be there and be, like, this weird archetype, and we're not going to question it. But and then, like, James McAvoy does as much as he can with Bill, but it, again, is, like, strangely distant because he's still, like, obsessing over Georgie, and he's not in the same place as, like,
Georgie,
a dead Georgie ever.
Georgie? You have to say it that way, please.
And the other actors, you know, give it a shot, including Jessica Chastain, but I really think the movie overestimates how much time we want to spend with the child characters over the adult characters, and how much time or how much mileage they could get out of each character individually, when wow, the whole thing that made the first movie work was they were all together, and they're really not all together, but, you know, for two or three big scenes in this movie.
Well, like I say, I sat in on a preview of It Chapter 2 at Comic-Con, and this, that presentation both speaks to, I guess, Andy Muschietti's, his strengths as a scene setter and as someone who I think can pull off these little scare moments that worked for me in the first movie. I didn't love the first It, but it has some really genuinely scary set pieces, and again, like, Bill Skarsgård is perfect casting. The fact that he can really do that eye twitching thing, that's real. That's not CG or anything. He really does that. And he's just perfect as Pennywise. And I think Uchietti can put together a pretty thrilling scene. The stuff that we saw at Comic-Con was the Chinese restaurant scene, which is both really fun and then instantly terrifying. And we saw some of the return to the Bolt House, right?
Neobolt House,
and you know, Pennywise turning into different objects and just looking really frightening. And then we saw some of the carnival stuff, or the House of Mirrors, and with the tongue and everything. Like, all of these little bits seem really scary, and I was excited to see it. And then all these people see the movie, and they're complaining that it's 3 hours long and just a total a drag. And I can imagine with this kind of bloat, that what Andy Muschietti is really good at, creating these tiny moments, would be lost. Pacing is everything. Like, do we know, is there another horror movie that's 3 hours long that's good? I think that Andy Muschietti is a real Kubrick head, based on this presentation at Comic-Con. Jessica Chastain and James McAvoy were kind of like joking, but not joking, about how grueling the shoot was. They would shoot take after take after take after take. And like Fincher-esque, Kubrick-esque, and even if it's like little details. Andy Muschietti, I guess he needs it.
That makes a lot of sense, because it seems like they're kind of tired. Like, right. Like, it's not fear that I'm seeing in the adult losers all the time, which, like, might work. The whole idea is that this, like, the story of it is about, like, overcoming, like, childhood trauma, but it's also about how, like, that trauma echoes forward from your past into your adulthood. And in the book, things like Beverly's husband is abusive, like, her dad was abusive. Bill's wife comes to Derry and is like sort of kidnapped by Tom, Beverly's husband. There are all these sort of like additional tendrils that bring the threat into the adult world, whereas here, outside of Stan, spoilers, it happens earlier on, killing himself rather than return to Derry, there isn't a threat. Like, Pennywise makes you see crazy things. Like, they're adults. Shouldn't they, you know, realize, like, finally at some point in the movie, when a guy gets stabbed by an escaped Henry Bowers in like the cheek, I'm like, finally an actual threat. And then literally 15 minutes later, like, Henry Bowers is dead. And I'm like, what? Why did we even do that? You like wasted. You wasted.
That's the thing.
Your
this movie
threatening
and this
thing.
Character are good for like jump scares. I like some of the mythology, what you're touching on with the turtle and the universes. That didn't really make it in the first movie, and I can understand why for horror-going audiences, maybe that didn't make sense. But this is a jump scare character, and it's a jump scare movie, and it's not The Shining. The Shining is allowed to be like 140 minutes long because it is sustaining this note of dread, and the intensity is slowly rising. It's a true slow burn. I didn't get the sense that It, Chapter One, was going to blossom into something Shining-esque. It should have been really wacky visuals with Pennywise. And yeah, maybe the childhood trauma notes would have been more poignant if they had been packaged tighter. That's really disappointing to hear. And I wonder if this movie will make the money to, I guess I always thought it was going to continue and be this huge horror franchise, but this movie may have killed it. It's fascinating to see an experience where a director gets like free reign. You know, the original It was originally going to be directed by Cary Fukunaga, and had a different cinematographer and a different behind the scenes crew. And this is more of Andy Muschietti's people working on It Chapter Two. It's interesting to see this kind of be a disaster. And I don't know if there's more of this to come. Does the movie kind of end on a note where they could do the Pennywise prequel or more stories in this universe? It seems not like it's not going to happen based
well,
on
first of
even
all, he's
the
on
box
the Flash movie,
here.
So that's what's happening next.
You think so? Do you think he's definitely getting that?
I don't know. I mean, he's the one That'll who's on the hot happen. Seat right now. Second of all, I completely agree with you that where his strengths are in like momentary tension and that sort of like jump scare or design, especially like his like creature design and the way he shoots them.
We like Mama.
It's terrible. Like, well, and what I like about Mama is that that's paired with like Guillermo del Toro's ghost story sensibility. So it kind of has that mystery bones to lay its plot on. I think when you bring somebody like Andy Muschietti to bear, it's like, I don't know who his adaptation person is off the top of my head, but like that person wasn't writing for the type of director that he is, because there's just so much time spent dependent on like mood. And then he's a smart enough director to know that you can't, you know, hold people. People are going to get tired and disengage with your movie. So his response is like to put some levity in there, which is great. But then sometime in like the what scenes made this movie and what scenes didn't make this movie, the levity completely overcame the scares. And then you're like, where's the clown? And why is this not scary anymore? Why am I at it? Chapter two. I took a screenshot of my phone without looking at the time when I realized that I wasn't liking the movie and I had only made it 62 minutes.
Oh no.
Into chapter two.
Maybe a minor disaster, it sounds like, from your words, but possibly worth watching when you have a six-hour flight and need to eat up half that time.
Oh, yeah. And then someday there's going to be, like, the crazy fan edit that cuts them both together, and that might actually be good, because it
really
is.
Okay, Topher Grace's It,
exactly.
The complete cut, coming to your computer in 2025.
Perfect.
I know your secret, your dirty little secret. I know your secret.
Okay, for this mini segment, we're going to talk about something. I'm just going to make an admission. And I think most people are in the same boat as me. In this crazy age of crammed TV schedules, I don't finish most shows that I start. Dave, do you? Or do you even, like, or are you committed to getting to the end?
I mean, that's my problem, is that if I start a show that right. I want to finish, like, then I'm like, well, I can't watch anything else until I finish it, and then before I know it, like, I'm reading? Oh, no, what's happening with me?
Yeah, because I end up watching so much for work, I'll do, like, one or two episodes, and I rarely really sit down and commit, because I genuinely don't, it doesn't grab me enough. Like, there's just so much to watch that I feel the opposite. I feel like I need to jump to the next thing to see if I'll get into that. And I watched to the end a show that I never thought I would, Amazon's The Boys, which I highly recommend, adapted from Garth Ennis's comic. Something I would never thought I would watch, you know, this like dark, gritty anti-hero tale about corporate superheroes and the underbelly organization that is trying to assassinate them for the better good of society. It is headlined by Carl Urban and Jack Quaid, Dennis Quaid's son. It has really a dark, dark sense of humor. It's extremely gory. And somehow my wife and I both were like, this is great. And it has, I think it, you know, speaking of It Chapter Two, I think it has everything to do with pacing, and it works its magic. It's just like the right scenes, the right direction and cinematography, and it's just the confluence of all the right elements. That's how you know you want to get to the end of a show, when every part of it is working. Great performances. There's this guy, Anthony Starr, who I wasn't familiar with, who plays the Superman proxy. He's fantastic. The show is just a knockout. I highly recommend it. But Dave, you and I are both a few episodes into a show that I know I'm not going to finish, and it makes absolutely no sense to me, because I am the geekiest person in the world. And I loved the Dark Crystal film when I was a kid. I watched it again on Netflix. It is whack shit. It's only like 80 minutes long, and I was very hyped for the Dark Crystal. And I've been seeing a lot of positive reactions to this show. There is no way I'm getting to the end of this kind of disaster of a show I was just so ready to love. And I'm really interested in your take, because much like It Chapter Two, this is just totally bloated entertainment, even when it's checking so many boxes. Incredible puppet animation, the loriest lore, nerd-ass shit, to use a common phrase on this podcast that I I've seen in something mainstream. This was clearly a Netflix executive's like pet project. There's no reason for the Dark Crystal Age of Resistance to exist. And yet here it is. And it is so boring. It's so aggressively boring. It worked as an 82 minute movie when I was a kid, but it is not working for me now.
When you were a kid, yes, but did it work as an 82 minute?
Well, when I showed it to everyone in freshman year of college, because I was like, this movie fucking rocks. It's going to send your brain into a knots. And everyone's like, you're high. And I'm like, not yet, buddy. not yet. Just watching this movie. No one liked me and no one liked that movie when I showed it. So maybe you're right. But what is going on? People really like it. And I'm a little lost. I'm not going to get to the end of the show and I'm disappointed. I'm pulling the ripcord. There's something good at the end, but what do you think?
So here's my hypothesis. I am also four episodes in, four of the, what, nine, is it? Ten?
And anyway, like solid hour long episodes.
Oh yeah, they are dense and you have to sit down and engage with them, because if you look away for a second, you might turn back and there will be some weird character or species that is there that you don't know if you're supposed to know that they're there.
So dense. But so still so fluffy. Like I can't, it's not like Game of Thrones or something where I want to know every piece of meticulously crafted lore detail. Like George R. R. Martin has conceived this fully fleshed out world. It's just baggage. It's just so much stuff to know and politicking. And I really actually love the first episode that they screened at Comic-Con, because it's all just the setup and then going
here
on.
Here's the part of the first episode where I started being concerned.
Yeah.
Characters in the library, reading at a podium. We come in behind her. We come up through the spiraling library. It's a beautiful CGI shot with a puppet base of the set that probably actually existed, but it is definitely some stitched together digital camera moves. Up to the top of the library, around the top level of the library, down the spiral of the library, back to her reading the book. And then we cut to a reverse shot for somebody coming in. The scene actually starts. And I'm like, holy shit. That's what we're in for. It's like, yes, it's another one. It's another product by Netflix this year that I don't know necessarily who it was made for, but I like it because I think it might be me. So here's the other part of my hypothesis for you, Patches. It's actually.
So you think you'll get to the end.
It's actually good.
Here it is.
And I'm going to be college age Patches here and just say that.
Bring me back.
It's its own pace, but it knows it and it commits to it and it executes on it, because it takes like 3 hours of me watching this to even know what the thrust of the series is. Because I've seen Dark Crystal, so I know that like the Skeksis and the Masters, what do they call them? Mystics.
The Mystics.
I know the Skeksis and the Mystics like fuse together and to like become a thing. So I know that the history that we're being monologued by Sigourney Weaver at the top is, you know, not accurate. So I'm immediately questioning, is like this actually a sequel? Is this like a weird prequel? And the thing's like, no, shh, look at these stairs. And you get there. And you get to this sort of like weird locked up feeling of this girl who eventually, you know, has to get like wrapped up in a vision adventure. And they're slowly pulling like your three threads together. And at least where I am at the end of episode 4, I think I now know what we're doing, and we're bringing like our cast together, and they're taking our time, and they're starting to stumble across secrets that I knew because I've seen Dark Crystal, but they're, you know.
Right. That's the other thing. It's a prequel. So we all ultimately know where it's all going to. I don't think you'd understand the show without having seen the movie, but there's also no dramatic tension because you've seen the movie.
I think you would understand. I think you would have a better time understanding the show if you hadn't seen the movie, because the movie.
Really?
Yeah, the show very matter-of-factly is like, I'm a female Gelfling, I have wings. All female Gelflings have wings. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, whereas like the movie, that would have been like, whoa! Like, can you imagine doing a prequel and having to like keep that a secret to all Gelflings? Anyway, they make certain choices like that. And then there's things like the Skeksis are still the same Skeksis from the movies.
Yes.
And they're all great because they're all people just hamming it up. and the puppets are still amazing. And the end of episode 2 has this really gruesome moment where they're punishing Mark Hamill's scientist with this like beetle they've made up that pries open and pops your eyeball. Yeah. And I'm just like, who is this? Who is this for?
And at times it's quite gruesome. It's bizarre.
And sometimes it's like watching firebirds go or whatever, because the Gelflings cannot be that expressive. And so you're like, I know there's supposed to be drama here, but like, please don't kiss and stuff like that. But then like other times, like, yeah, Skeksis are like having, you know, Wrath of Khan like bugs put on their faces. And you're like, oh, Jesus. Like, so I'm thinking it could stick the landing, and I could be like, look, yes, it's one of those series that takes really long, but it's like its own thing, and it's a good in its own thing. Because think about like how many like themes it's actually bringing up because it's able to be as complex as it is.
Yeah, and I mean, I am enchanted by the puppet animation, and I'm enchanted by all the camera moves. It's directed by Louis Leterrier, the Incredible Hulk fame and many parkour films. It has that directorial touch. It is looks really expensive. Unlike The Boys or something, where I have the human element, I have people having breakdowns, I have serious pathos and the heightened experience of the superheroes being like supervillains, and just the moral compass being crushed, and it's always kind of raising the bar. Nothing in Dark Crystal, it's a weird thing to compare, but like Ryan the Gelfling from the Stonewood Clan and Bria the Gelfling Princess of the Vapra Clan. I have nothing to cling to. It's Hero's Journey 101. This is not well thought out lore. It just is lore, and I can't get on. To wrap this up, like, what are you invested in the show that's going to take you through 10 hours of Dark Crystal?
It feels like reading Lord of the Rings.
Really?
You're like, ah, fucking songs again. But like, yeah, eventually those songs become texture in a world.
Lord of the Rings has Sam and Frodo. They feel the elements and they are driven by the biggest task imaginable, going up against Sauron to destroy the ring. You're telling me you feel like Dark Crystal has that? Either it's the MacGuffin or the momentum, the like stakes, the pressure. What element?
That's not exactly what I said. I said it feels like reading Lord of the Rings, which is an experience that I like. I'm not saying it is Lord of the Rings, but like any sort of like in-depth fantasy novel or epic, the world building for most authors, some authors, can be as important as the plot. I don't know. I mean, but I like love like Hup, the little podling like knight who carries around a spoon.
Yeah.
And like I kind of like all the Skeksis, and like because I'm like also not as invested in the Gelflings, I don't mind that we spend about equal time on both of them, even though there's not really a conflict, because I know they're gonna, you know, mine the crystal for essence. It's just really interesting to see, like, you know, the weird Gelfling societies reject each other, and how not seeing the divide between your own people will eventually lead to your authoritarian takeover. And I feel it's an interesting time to have fantasy literature and television shows explore that possibility.
I think it's a little more like reading The Silmarillion than it is reading Lord of the Rings. But watching it in like 10-minute chunks,
I've got a hope and a prayer.
Yeah.
Hey, David, the most important movie of Toronto was Hustlers, right?
Indubitably. That's a word. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something they would definitely say in Hustlers.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's like mostly half the script. Hustlers, a masterpiece. What more needs to be said?
You saw it for the first time in Toronto, right?
I did not. I actually, if you want to get into a humble brag I've never been able to make before. I saw it a while back because my good friend Todd, who shot my student films back when I was dumb enough to try making those, is a cinematographer on Hustlers.
Oh, amazing. So wait, did you see it with a crowd, or were you like in a screening room somewhere?
I saw it with a crowd of, you know, non-human parasitical critic types, but who were not there to review the movie over the summer. But
I saw it at press screening in Toronto, yeah. But still, like, seeing that movie with an audience, for anyone listening to this who has the chance to go see Hustlers this weekend, it's the best.
Did it kill?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just so, like, people were just, like, laughing out loud. Like, there's that one shot of J-Lo early on where she's, like, leaning in the fur coat on the roof, and people laughed and, like, applauded. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like, screenings for that movie opening weekend, especially, I feel like, in bigger cities, are going to be a total party. Except for, you know, the movie is not the light and glossy fairy tale that the ads might want you to think it is. I think it has a lot more in common, especially in the second half, with something like Goodfellas than it does Magic Mike, even if the underlying themes are similar.
Sure, but I think it gets you on the happiness in that first half, and then so by the time it starts turning dark, you're like so there.
And J-Lo, who, let it be known, I mean, I think you and I are in total agreement with this, is all right thinking people should be, deserves an Oscar.
Oh, she's president now, actually. You're still in Canada, so you missed that.
Oh, I haven't learned that. Yeah, this is going to be her photo framed at the airport at Newark.
What an amazing way to come home.
God, that would be so good. But, yeah, she is incredible in this. And in the first hour in particular, I mean, like, she, her part really resonates all the way into the last scene. But in the first part of the movie, she is bringing a lot of good vibes. And it is a very good time.
Yeah, I don't want, like, so I don't know, like, what the direction for this conversation is, but, like, I'm talking about Oscar stuff, obviously, elsewhere. So I feel like maybe of interest to people listening to this might be Knives Out, which we don't want to spoil, but to me was the other, like, oh my God, see this in a big theater full of people of TIFF.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Fantastic Fest notwithstanding, I don't know if that movie will ever play quite as well as it did at the premiere screening at the Princess of Wales here, where it was just, like, people were fucking lapping up every single line of dialogue, and not without reason. I mean, like, it is a very, Rian Johnson's written a very sharp, very funny script and invited all sorts of amusing performances into the mix.
And do you have a particular favorite?
Hard to say who my MVP is. As happy as I am to see Ana de Armas get a lead role that she can really, I think she brings a lot of really good texture to. I mean, Daniel Craig is obviously having the time of his life doing sort of a more amped up version of what he did in Logan Lucky.
I forgot about Logan Lucky.
I don't know. Who is your standout?
I mean, Toni Collette would be another big one to point out there. Also, Christopher.
I wanted her part to be bigger.
Yeah. I mean, her and Michael Shannon have kind of like some smaller parts than you expect. But I guess that's the whole idea of a whodunit is that you don't like, you don't know who's going to be like
everyone's
to the mystery. Everyone's a suspect. Yeah. And Christopher Plummer, I thought on that count was like pretty, like, I mean, he's a great actor, but like he made a lot of a part when you kind of imagine him coasting at this point in his life.
Yeah. And the movie, I mean, he dies in the very first scene of the movie. I mean, it's how the movie begins.
He is at the center of the whodunit.
He is right. He is the body. And, but the movie plays with your expectations in a way that, I don't want to say anything more, but you know, there's ample opportunity for everyone to shine. Very satisfying. Also has one of the, for a movie that is satisfying is really the word to describe it. Because you feel well nourished when it's over, but it has such a perfect last shot. I think for, Rian Johnson, always a little bit too, other than The Last Jedi, which I love, always a little bit too literal minded. For me, is very into rules and games, and I think gets caught up in that sometimes. And finally, he has made a movie about those things that I think so innately suits his strengths that it really is my favorite of his films, other than Last Jedi, which I love.
I think you and I have both been like, you know, not like, I respect Rian Johnson a lot. I like the work that he does, but I've always found him like a little more clever than like appealing. But I feel like Knives Out is like the perfect place for him to.
100%. 100%. What was your favorite film that you saw here?
The favorite one was Parasite, which was at Cannes and is another movie like Knives Out that you don't really want to talk about in that much detail because it has a lot of surprises within it. It won the Palme d'Or. People have been talking about Cannes since Cannes about how much it rules, but like, unlike a lot of things that from Cannes that come to TIFF and you're like, okay, I guess I got to see this French movie about like, was it when the Marion Cotillard one about the whale trainer? Wasn't that like the Palme d'Or winner that came to TIFF?
Rustin Bone.
But it's really fun.
Yeah, she got her
legs. It's fun almost in like, it's not as fun as Knives Out, but it's extremely fun. I mean, you've been like beating the drum for this movie since Cannes. You don't need me to tell you.
Yeah. Parasite fucking rules. But did you see, if that was your favorite movie here, I have to assume you didn't see Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I think it was my fourth favorite movie I saw in TIFF. I mean, I tweeted this. Like my top five movies from TIFF, I think, are all basically perfect. Like, I had a really good run.
What were the other three?
Hang on. I'll pull it up on my phone. It's Parasite, Hustlers, Knives Out, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and Marriage Story.
Yeah, so Marriage Story, which I caught it, I didn't do it this much because it was chaotic, even for a more accessible. But I don't know where I am in space and time right now. But I watched that movie over there. And I am totally open to the fact that I just may not have been on its rhythm the first time out. There are scenes and moments and things about it that I love as much as anything Noah Baumbach has done. But as a whole, I didn't really feel like it cohered into something more than some of its parts. And I found the last two scenes, the penultimate scene in particular, to be
wrong about that. It's crazy how wrong you are about the penultimate scene.
I don't think there's any reason we have to divulge what it is, but you didn't find it manipulative?
I mean, I don't know.
Kind of strained.
I think the movie does a good job of like being kind of like on the wavelength of reality and of these people and kind of making all of its theatrics in the dialogue between these people, which is kind of a Noah Baumbach move. So then it can kind of move into something a little bit bigger and maybe manipulative. And I was kind of there with it. What also made me appreciate it more is I saw like a much more average marital drama story called Ordinary Love, which is totally fine. It's got Liam Neeson and Leslie Manville as a married couple. You can't argue with that. But it made me appreciate Marriage Story more, like the way that it has this tight script that like draws out all these details of this relationship and in ways that you like don't necessarily notice. So go see some.
I will say that Marriage Story did make me appreciate even more than I already did Adam Driver, who is just incredible in it. Has a scene involving a knife that is truly immortal. But a movie that made me, it's so good, but a scene that made me appreciate Marriage Story less, or a film that made me appreciate Marriage Story less, contrary to what Katie was saying, is a film called Emma by Pablo Larraín, who is Jackie and Neruda, and Katie's favorite, No. You guys want No?
No!
Stand for No on this podcast. Emma is a very much described movie about a sort of, I tried to sort of give people an idea in my review. I said something to the effect of like, it's like Amelie meets Old Boy by way of climax or something. I mean, it's a very strange story set in Valparaiso, Chile, about a Gael Garcia Bernal is in it, and he is married to a dancer who there's something about a boy, a child of theirs who they adopted and then gave back, and a flamethrower and a lot of dance and a great Nicholas Jar score. But they are the most dysfunctional couple of the year. The movie basically opens with 10 minutes of them each staring directly into the lens and just saying the most devastating things about one another, so much so that Marriage Story kind of felt like a pillow fight.
I mean, compared to that. I don't think Marriage Story has to be as devastating as possible. I think maybe one of its strengths is that it's not. No. Like, you meet this couple when they're trying to have this amicable divorce without lawyers, and then if you know that Laura Dern plays a divorce lawyer in this movie, you know that it doesn't quite pan out that way.
Katie, what did you think? Absolutely what you said. You're right. What did you think of Wade?
Oh, God. I don't really like Waves. I don't think it's a bad movie. It came to TIFF with all this buzz from Telluride, and people tend talking about it being a big deal, and it's an A24 movie with all this style, and I think some people at A24 have been actively comparing it to Moonlight, which, you know, it's set in Miami and has a lot of style and color to it, so you see that. But it had all of this like directorial flourish on top of a story that was just like so predictable, like exactly the high school movie you thought you were going to see, until then it pivots to something else in the back half, which is another sort of predictable movie that I liked more. But that was the one movie at Toronto that I sat through being like, hang on, I did not sign up for this.
Yeah, I mean, the first hour feels like an entire season of Euphoria condensed into it.
Yeah, and as we know, I quit watching Euphoria.
Yeah, and then the movie becomes something different. I do think that if you take a couple steps back, I think it's one of those movies that I really appreciate what it's trying to do, the overall sort of operatic sweep of the whole thing. I think the nitty-gritty of it in the moment didn't necessarily work for me. I was a little bit confused by the rapturous reception it got out of Telluride, but I do think that it is another step for Trey Edward Schultz moving in a much bigger, interesting direction. It left me even more curious to what he's going to do next.
Does it feel like something where he should not write his own scripts? Like, because he's a really good filmmaker. Like the opening of this movie where it's following this like kid throughout his day and the camera's in the car with him and like swirling around. And it's really thrilling.
Oh, yeah.
And then when the story kicks in, you're like, oh, hang on. Like, this is like a rejected Friday Night Lights plot.
Certainly has an interest in dysfunctional families, the situation in a very visceral way of capturing them on camera. The first shot of the movie brought me back to my memories as a teenager driving and reminded me just how much teenagers should maybe not be allowed to drive.
Yeah, no, the movie is stressful for a lot of reasons, but I was definitely convinced everyone was going to die in a horrible car crash because none of them were
responsible. Yeah, I wish that someone had told me before the movie that there are no serious car accidents in the movie.
I would like that as a warning before most movies. Like, because if they say there is a serious car accident, then you spend the entire time on really on high alert.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, every time, I think, you know, Adaptation and a couple of other movies really ruin the crowd forever, that every time you have a tense conversation scene inside of a car, you're just waiting to be sideswiped. And it all makes it super tense. And maybe that helps this movie here, but did not help me engage with it on maybe a different level. But I also am incredibly excited to see what Corey Finley, director of Thoroughbreds and now Bad Education, does next. Although I thought, did you see Bad Education?
No, that's what's like that and the Mr. Rogers one were like the two that I missed other stuff played after I left. But yes, I missed those two.
Bad Education is much, much, for me anyway, more satisfying than Waves was, much more vision. It stars Hugh Jackman in my favorite performance of his since The Prestige.
That's amazing.
Not to say he hasn't been good since, but this is the most interesting sort of approach to his and dilution of his showmanship with something more human. It is a movie that is going to be very difficult to sell because it is about a Long Island superintendent of the Roswell District Schools, and the various other people in his administration who get caught up in an embezzlement fund. It's a true story that was experienced firsthand by screenwriter Mike Makowski when he was a student there. It is not especially sexy. And it's Hugh Jackman, despite being completely Oscar worthy in it, his role is not as big or as flashy as it would need to do sort of I, Tonya awards push that can push a movie over the hump.
Well, it still doesn't have a distributor, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's going to be an uphill battle for that one, but it's so, so good. It's so smart. It's so empathetic. It builds to, the most unexpectedly moving dance scene I can remember since there's these 35 shots of rum.
Wow.
Moby finally has a good moment in that. It's been a rough year. He's redeemed in a way. But Bad Education, I assume because of its cast, Allison Janney is also in it, Ray Romano, Geraldine Viswanathan, Alex Wolff, I think. Alex Wolff.
Yeah, I never heard the difference between
the two. It'll get picked up somewhere, but it's hard to say where. Was there anything else you saw, like a smaller variety that really you took a chance on? We have to talk about
Which one?
Uncut Gems.
But we should fight about The Friend too if we have time, because that's a small chance on.
We are talking as fast as possible because Katie's kids are coming home any minute.
We'll probably hear them come on this audio track. So I walked out of Uncut Gems like truly not knowing what to make of anything. Like, it is about all kinds of cultures that I don't know anything about, from like the Diamond District to sports betting, but it is like such a complete vision and so gripping. And even with like all kinds of things that I don't like and don't necessarily want to spend time with, you kind of can't look away from it, which I know is like the Safdie brothers' specialty at this point. I think, like, in the end, I'm a fan. I think I admire it more than love it, but it's so unforgettable. Like, you're so wrapped up in that thing.
Adam Sandler, man.
He's great in it.
I said something that I think was misinterpreted by some, when I was like, he is both the best and the worst actor currently living, or the worst and the best actor currently living, which is probably not even, is an allusion to the like lazy ass Netflix movies he does.
Sure.
And how brilliant he is whenever he decides to spread his wings. But even in those Netflix movies, he's not as bad as other people I could think of. But
he's the laziest and most interesting actor alive.
Yeah. That is not as good as more true. He's so fucking good in this. He, yeah. God, and like,
And for a while, I was thinking like, oh, it's him screaming, but like in a more of a drama than a comedy. But like, it really evolves from there. Like, you're so in this guy's head as he's like stressfully trying to like handle all of his insane debts that he's accrued, and yeah, he accomplishes that.
The read on this movie was that it's as stressful to get the shtick of Valium going in, and it's hard to dispute that.
It's really
it has like even more of an intense nervous energy, playing around with addiction in the same way that something like
heaven knows what.
Heaven knows what did, and yeah, and the addiction of heaven is for real. The sort of anxiety of Good Time as well. This is even more weaponized, sort of like a 70s thriller kind of vibe to it. And Adam Sandler carries it from start to finish in a truly committed performance that is, I don't know if it's good Jewish representation, but it's certainly a lot of Jewish representation.
We need Jordan Hoffman to weigh in on whether this is good for the Jews.
Oh boy, do we ever! It is a lot for the Jews. And honestly, if I can speak on behalf of myself and the other Jews I was talking to, we will take it.
Yeah.
This is a movie that features people finding the Afikoman. Adam Sandler reads all 10 of the Passover plagues.
Judd Hirsch is in it.
Judd Hirsch is definitely in it.
Francesca's in it.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, not a Jew.
Not a Jew, but a tri-state area icon.
Lakeith Stanfield talking about black Jews in it. Very exciting. And not just talking about them as like a thing, but like learning about them and getting really excited.
Should we mention that the one party we went to together was the Uncut Gems party, and we spent about 5 minutes in the incredibly loud room full of black lights that The Weeknd was in and said, no, thank you.
The Weeknd was in The Weeknd and his 90-deep entourage walked in. I have to say, The Weeknd's new hairstyle looked real, real good on him. He looked very spiffy. And he walked in, very little man, and the room was, all the music was just blasting The Weeknd's music while he sat there listening to his own music.
Yeah.
It was a sight.
It's kind of appropriately surreal for that movie.
Yes. And then we left.
Yeah. Okay, my kids are home. Real quick, The Friend is pretty good. I read your review. I think your problems are valid, but I still liked it overall.
Well, as long as my problems are valid, I don't have a problem with that. The Friend, yeah, I mean, it's Dakota Johnson, Jason Segel, and we ride or die for Jason Segel in this house. And Casey Affleck, who we have a much more complicated relationship with.
I have a complicated but genuinely affectionate relationship. I like basically everything Casey Affleck does, even though I understand.
Yeah,
that's
I love him as an actor, but complicated also.
Sure.
And you know, it's a true life cancer story based on an Esquire article about a couple, and she gets cancer, and Jason Segel, who plays both of their old friends, moves in sort of on a permanent basis to. Yeah, sort of help around, be caretaker. And I thought the movie was totally undone by its nonlinear flashback heavy structure. But Katie, you're not the only one who seemed moved by it.
I thought the flashback structure did get a little like herky jerky at points, but I thought like the relationship between the three main characters, mostly Casey Affleck and Jason Segel, and also the way he plays this guy who just like does this incredible selfless thing, but it just makes perfect sense to him and then makes perfect sense to us. Like there's all these nice like lived in scenes with them as a family and as friends, like both in the flashbacks and I think more in the present day. And it's just the way that it's about the process of dying, but also like the people who are left behind and kind of like how they figure out how to live in their lives. I mean, the Esquire article it's based on is like so graphic and vivid about what really happens when people die, and the movie I think probably wisely doesn't do that. Like I don't think you want to see like Dakota Johnson like in like organ failure or pretending to be an organ failure, and she's also like she's way too young for this. She's good, but like it makes no sense that she and Casey Affleck are married.
And as I think you may have pointed out, the kids never age.
Yeah. Kids don't age.
But it is kind of movie where it's like they make an oblique reference to some sort of a fear in the first like 20 minutes,
and then
you just sit
it, like,
there waiting
later.
For like an hour to go to the flashback where that comes up again. You're like, come on, go.
Yeah, I think I was on board with it at that point and wasn't bothered. But like, listen, it's not going to be for everybody. But I do think if you like don't mind a weepy and like maybe would mind seeing like a cancer movie that does something a little bit different and tells, I mean, the real story is so like unique about this three people, not just this couple. But I thought it was pretty gripping.
Yeah, David.
I'm going to go.
I wish. Yep.
Real quick, is the Joker going to ruin society, yes or no?
I think society has already been ruined, which is really the Joker's point in a way. But it's certainly not going to make anything better.
All right. Well, we'll have time to talk about it. It's coming out in a few weeks. Have fun in Canada while you're still there.
I will try another 24 hours to go. And then maybe you can try not being at a film festival for a hot minute.
Sounds like a great idea.
Get back in my life.
We'll catch up with you when you're recovering next week.
Okay, goodbye.
All right, good luck. Bye.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, do it!
Yeah. Fear them.
Yeah. We've got a hot one for you.
Fear them.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. That's the end of the episode. Yeah, no one recorded any outros this week. Patches and I, obviously, because we were rambling. And David and Katie, because they didn't have any time traveling back from Toronto. So, as always, you can follow the show at FITWR on Twitter. You can find us online at FightingInTheWarRoom.com. You can find Katie at Vanity Fair and at KATEYRICH on Twitter. You can find Patches at Mr. Patches on Twitter. And at Polygon.com, you can find David at IndieWire and all his reviews there. You can also find him online on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You're going to have to Google how he spells his last name. He doesn't like you asking. And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me at DA70 on Twitter and also on the Storm Lost Rewatch podcast. We're almost through season one. Come join us over there. Sorry this episode was late. It was entirely my fault. Have a great weekend. Still don't see you chapter 2, though.
And all I really want is for us to get along. For us to get along. She makes my Mondays feel like Fridays. She makes my Ruby Tuesdays taste like Penny-onas. And all I really want is for us to get along. For us to get along.
Bum-ba-dum, da-tum-pum-dum. A-pum-pum-dum, da-da-gum-gum. Ba-bum-ba-bum-ba-bum. Now I'm done. We're done.